Too late to take advantage of the connections that come off the field from being a big-time college athlete. Instead, they'd opted to keep it real in Monk's Corner. At the time, I couldn't understand why they'd give up so easily, but today I can see a lot of it had to do with anxiety. I never went to college myself, but I'm sure it's very stressful to be from a small town like Monk's Corner and find yourself on a major college campus. Even if you're a D1 athlete, your roommate might be from New York or Los Angeles. They might be knowledgeable about stuff you've never heard about. They might dress better than you, have more money than you, know about foods you've never tasted. Try talking to a dude from NYC about hunting deer and then eating it. He will look at you confused and disgusted, like you just told him construction timberlands are trash. My cousins might have been big dogs back in Monk's Corner, but on a college campus, they probably felt like country bumpkins, which made them insecure, which made them sad. What do most people do when they feel unsure of themselves in a new situation? They retreat back to the familiar. They return to what's comfortable, even if it's not in their best interest. This is why I feel the motivation behind keeping it real isn't really loyalty. It's not bravado. It's not fearlessness. It's anxiety. Once you can accept that, it becomes easier to get past it. It's okay to feel out of place in a new situation. There's no shame in not knowing about certain fashions, customs, or foods. That's the whole point of evolution. You take your core and then build on it, not retreat back into a negative space. To anyone who feels insecure about stepping out of the hood and into a better opportunity, I'd remind you of the old quote, "It's better to try and fail than fail to try." My cousins and so many hood kids just like them around the country failed to try. Don't make that same mistake. And to be clear, not hanging out doesn't mean never giving back. No, you've always got to do that. But just by making it to a new place, you're showing the hood that evolution is possible. You're showing a path that people like you can take to help reach another level in life. Once you get there, by all means, give back to the community. Create a nonprofit. Help build some affordable housing. Offer kids scholarships. That's how you make a difference, but you don't have to go back if you don't want to. You don't have to sit on the same bench you sat on as a kid smoking weed. You don't have to stand around drinking and playing CeeLo on the same corner you used to. What are you proving by that? Only that you don't value your success. Survivor's remorse. I no longer feel the need to hang out when I'm in Monk's Corner, but I still feel a lot of anxiety about the people I've left behind. Yes, the pettiness and jealousy I encountered can get under my skin, but at the end of the day, I truly want all of them to experience the same success I have. I want their world to expand like mine has. I want their future to look as bright as mine does. That's because I know the odds they face their whole lives. I know the dysfunction they've been embroiled in. I felt the desperation that can hover over you like a cloud. Sometimes I wonder, why was I able to overcome the hurdles that tripped them up? Sometimes fatally. Was it my father staying on my case all those years, refusing for all his own BS to let me succumb to the streets? Was it the influence of my mother, the school teacher who instilled a love of reading in me? Was it the presence of mentors like Dr. Robert Evans of Never So Deep Records who always pointed me in the right direction when I reached the crossroads? Or was it God herself who somehow kept me on the righteous path even when I was doing my damnedest to go astray? I don't know. I'm far from alone in asking those questions. There are so many men and women from the hood who have elevated their lives but are still troubled by a nagging sense that somehow they don't deserve it, or who feel that their success came at someone else's expense. There's a term for this feeling, survivor's guilt. It refers to the guilt someone can feel when they survive an event that has damaged, traumatized, or killed people around them. It's an emotion people have probably been feeling for thousands of years, but therapists first put a name to it after working with Jews who had survived the Holocaust. Those survivors were haunted not only by the trauma they'd experienced, but also by guilt. Some couldn't wrap their heads around being alive after having seen so many others die. Others felt guilty about what they had done to survive, maybe stealing food from another Jew at the concentration camp, or avoiding a situation that led to another Jew's death. They made hard choices in order to survive in captivity, but once they were free, they had a hard time living with those decisions. Survivor's guilt was also prevalent in the gay community following the AIDS crisis of the 80s and early 90s. So many people lost friends, family members, and lovers. Some questioned the fairness of a world where they were alive but their partners died. Others felt guilty for not doing enough to protect a friend or a family member from choices that would ultimately kill them. And many simply felt depression and rage over so little being done to fight a disease that killed so many bright and talented people. Survivor's guilt has also been a major theme in hip-hop. Most rappers came from the hood, where they might have experienced poverty, racism, violence, and abuse. Once they get some real money in their pockets, they make the move to the suburbs to get away from all that dysfunction. Some folks call the towns of Fort Lee and Englewood in New Jersey Rapper's Row because so many rappers live there in luxury apartments overlooking Manhattan. But there's also a lot of pain that comes with leaving the hood behind. The memory of the homies who died before they got a chance to taste success with you. The knowledge that even though your circumstances have improved, there are so many other hard-working, good-hearted people who are going to stay stuck in the hood for the rest of their lives. One artist who has done an incredible job at articulating survivor's guilt is Kendrick Lamar, especially in his classic album, The Pimp a Butterfly. A native of Compton, Kendrick talks a lot about his difficulty reconciling his newfound fame with the lives most of his homies are still living back on the streets. He told MTV, "You live in this life, but you still have to face the realities of what's happening back at home. I gotta get back off that tour bus and go to these funerals. It's definitely survivor's guilt. How can I be a voice for all these people around the world and can't reach them like I want to? And they're the closest to me. That's a trip." According to Kendrick, that sense of being unable to help elevate his homies almost drove him insane. He was quoted as saying, "That can draw a thin line, you know, between having your sanity and losing it. This is how artists deteriorate if you don't catch yourself. My release therapy is writing the music," end quote. LeBron James is not a rapper, but another person whose words on survivor's guilt have resonated with me. He even produced a TV show called Survivor's Remorse, which is loosely based on his life. LeBron touches on the other side of the coin Kendrick discussed, which is the feeling that your homies are mad at you for leaving them behind. He told CNN, "I have always had a problem with people saying you've changed over the years. I would hope that you've changed for the better. My problem is I would always tell them you were the one with the issue because you have not changed. You're still in the same position you were 4 or 5 years ago. And it happens in our society a lot, in the black community. We'd rather stay together and both struggle than one of us making it and us being happy for the person who made it." It's true. For too long, there's been a crabs in the barrel attitude in the hood. If we see someone getting too big, our first instinct is to pull them back down to us instead of studying their moves so that we can get out too. We want to pull them back into the pack. You'll often hear people say, "Haters gonna hate," as if it's a fact of life. I don't believe it always has to be this way, though. I prefer to subscribe to the philosophy of each one teach one. That means if I get to a better place in life, I'm gonna try to show you how to get there too. I'm going to put myself out there to help you, even if it gives you another chance to pull me back into the barrel. Or as the Queen Cardi B famously said, "Don't be a why her and not me type of bitch. Be a how can I get next to that bitch type of bitch." Of course, trying to help the homies back in the hood can create its own issue. I say there's a Jay-Z lyric for every situation, and trying to deal with survivor's guilt is no exception. In Nickels and Dimes, he talks about the challenges of trying to live by the each one teach one ethos. "Sometimes I feel survivor's guilt," he raps. "I gave some money to this guy, he got high as hell. Now I'm part of the problem far as I can tell." I know so many other successful black folks have found themselves in this situation. Someone from your hood asks you for money and you feel compelled to say yes, even if you don't feel confident it's going to be put to good use. After all, this person is from the same place as you. You know what they've been through, what you've been through together, so you do them a favor, but they end up blowing the money and souring the relationship, which leads to more tension and bad feelings. That's why in one of the next lines, Jay raps, "I got a problem with the handouts. I took the man route. I'll give an opportunity, though. That's the plan now." Man, I am definitely on Jay's plan now. I'm not allowing guilt to cloud my judgment any longer. I'll lend a helping hand to anyone who needs it, but before I do, I need to see evidence that they're going to put it to good use. To give you an example, one of my homeboys texted me the other day asking for help getting his music out there. That might sound like a fairly reasonable request, but to me it was ridiculous. This guy is closing in on 40 and is still trying to get put on as a rapper. That drove me crazy because if you're a student of the rap game in 2018, then you would know that no one gets put on anymore. Thanks to the internet, you put yourself on now. You create some fire music and then build up a fan base online. You can record your music on a laptop if you can't afford studio time. You can film videos with your damn iPhone if you can't afford a videographer. If you're good enough and consistent enough, over time, you're going to get recognized. People are going to comment, follow you, like you, and retweet you. When that happens enough, then that's when a record label might be interested in you. If that record label doesn't come calling, you can still make some type of living from shows, streaming dollars, and merchandise if you're savvy enough. That's how you get on. Not because someone who's made it said you're hot. Those days are long over. My friend should have known that, but he was hoping he could skip over all the steps that involved hard work. I had to set him straight. Bro, stop asking me about music, I texted him. You're almost 40. Let's find something else to work on together. I thought that was an honest and encouraging response. Maybe he'd hit me with a plan to open a fast food franchise or start his own construction firm. Those are the type of projects I want to support with my success, not 40-year-old rap dreams. My friend didn't see things that way. Yo, man, hit me when my friend come back, he quickly replied, because I don't know who this new nigga is. Yo, I'm the same person who's been telling you the truth your whole life, I texted back. Just like I'm telling you the truth now. We both know you're not gonna make it as a rapper, and that's not a diss. I love you to death, but you've got to figure out something else to do. It's not easy to have a conversation like that with an old friend, but it's necessary if you want to maintain a healthy relationship with the people you came up with. They might claim you've changed. That accusation will sting. But you've got to have confidence to know that the issue isn't that you're different, but rather they have failed to evolve. Yes, when I was 19, me and my homie were trying to make it as rappers, like a lot of other kids were. But at a certain point, I took stock of my situation and accepted that I was garbage on the mic. How did I come to that realization? Because as my mentor, Dr. Robert Evans, was kind enough to tell me, fuck your dreams. You suck as a rapper. That forced me to admit that I didn't have what it takes. So I changed up my course and pursued a different avenue, which was radio. I was able to reach a much higher level of success in radio than I would have ever touched as a rapper. My homie never took an honest stock of his situation. If you're still trying to get on more than 20 years after you started, either you're not good enough, disciplined enough, or passionate enough to make it as a rapper. You need to change course. Hell, you should want to change course. Who wants to keep driving down the same dead-end street year after year? Unfortunately, some people do. They are just more comfortable staying stuck in that proverbial barrel than following their path to freedom. It can be very painful to be close to someone like that. But what I've learned is that you can't blame yourself for their inaction. The only way you're going to be able to take care of the people around you is if you practice self-care first. That might sound selfish, but it's just common sense. Think about when you're about to take off on a plane and the flight attendants show you how to use the oxygen mask when they're released. What do they always say? If you're traveling with children, secure your mask first and then put on the child's. That's because they know you have to get your own situation secure before you can help someone else. That's true in the rest of life, too. You must make sure you've got your own situation together before you can truly help anyone else. It is okay to feel sad for your friends who seem to be stuck in place. Just as it's definitely okay to mourn for your friends or family who are no longer here. No one is saying that you can't feel that pain in your heart. What you have to guard against, however, is being paralyzed by that guilt. When I recently told my mother I was feeling guilty about that conversation I'd had with my old friend, the one who said I changed, she cut me right off. You don't have anything to feel guilty about, she told me. You don't have to do things just because people ask. You didn't get to where you got by asking for things. You put in work and good things happened. The people asking you for help can do that too. You don't owe them anything. I went through something similar with a family member who had recently asked me for a loan. I've always made it clear that I'll be there for my family when there's a real emergency at hand. Sudden surgery, bail, funeral costs, I've got all of those, but I feel like too often I get hit up for situations that don't really merit me stepping in. Recently, a family member had asked me to pay for their kid's summer camp. Of course I want the kid to go to camp and have a memorable experience. But I also know the kid's father has a good job. Why can't he pay for his own child's camp? I didn't know what to say, so I stalled in getting back to them with an answer. Then one day, I was looking at an Iron Man suit that I wanted to buy for myself for Halloween. This thing was really kitted out. Body armor, handmade from fiberglass with flexible joints and LED lights in the hands, chest, and helmet. The Marvel fan in me just had to have it. The price tag, however, was $3,000. I could afford it without a problem, but as I debated clicking the purchase button, I started feeling guilty. I was going to tell a family member I couldn't pay for one of their kids to go to camp, yet I was willing to pay $3,000 for a Halloween costume for myself. It didn't seem right. I was really conflicted, so I decided to ask my wife for advice. "Get the goddamn suit," she replied, after I shared my guilt with her. "You work hard for your money. You don't owe anyone an explanation for what you want to buy for yourself. Plus, you're always helping people out. It's okay to say no." It was very freeing to hear that from my wife, just as it had helped to hear something similar from my mother. My mother's message to me was the family has to stop asking for stuff unless it is an emergency. I really appreciated my wife and my mother letting me know that it was okay to say no. Feeling that I owed people a yes was unnecessarily bringing anxiety and stress into my life. It was making me regret my hard-earned success instead of enjoying it. Which is not to mean that I've cut myself off from my roots forever. In discussing my mixed emotions with my therapist, I realized that rather than worry about how other people feel, the most constructive thing I can do is focus my attention on the people who matter the most to me. I can work on making a difference in their lives. I want to help the family of the people I feel like I owe. Those who are no longer here. Like my brother Jarrell Garnett. We both grew up without having much. We both turned to selling drugs. We both had some talent. Jarrell could rap his ass off much better than I ever could. We spent a lot of time together dreaming about making it as rappers. But even after I turned my attention to radio, Jarrell never fully removed himself from the streets. Eventually, our paths diverged, even though we would speak all the time and see each other whenever I would go down to South Carolina. Then a few years ago, he was murdered in a recording studio in Moss Corner. When I got that call, I really didn't know how to process his loss. I was like, damn, but I didn't cry. I didn't smash a window or fall to the floor in tears. I didn't even call his family to offer condolences. I just went numb. Emotionally, I turned the channel and didn't look back. When it was time for his funeral, I sent some flowers and paid respects to his mother, Jimmy Sue, but that's all I could do. The guilt was killing me. It didn't seem fair that I got to enjoy life with my kids, but his would never have their father. I felt like I could have done more to get him out of the hood, but I wasn't quite in position yet to do that, or maybe I was already in position and didn't realize it. If I had promoted his music more, promoted him more, then maybe he wouldn't have stayed on the streets. He'd be alive today. Those children would have a father. Jimmy Sue would still have a son. But then I'm like, well, he didn't die on the streets. He died in a recording studio working on his dreams. The bullets weren't even meant for him. I couldn't really articulate those emotions before going to therapy and writing this book. It was tough, too painful to consider, but now that I have, I realize avoiding that pain wasn't the answer because it never really goes away. Instead, it just keeps me stuck in place emotionally. To move forward, I really need to do something meaningful for Jarrell's kids, for his mother. It might be money, but it could just be opportunity. Maybe it's just stopping by and talking to his kids about their father. Right now, I don't have a relationship with them at all. I can build with them about all the great times I had with their father and what a special talented person he was. And when they're a bit older, I can maybe lend a hand to help them realize their dreams. Hopefully they will read this and one day come to me with this page to hold me to my word. Taking specific, impactful steps for the people you care about is the best way to deal with survivor's guilt. I can't worry about what a bitter old classmate in a bar might say about me, or whether an old friend is upset I won't bankroll his pipe dreams. What I can do, and what anyone feeling survivor's guilt can do, is try to impact the lives of those I still feel the closest bond to. I can't save all of Monk's Corner, just like Kendrick can't save all of Compton, Jay-Z all of Brooklyn, or LeBron all of Akron. But we can direct resources to work wherever our heart tells us they'll have the most meaningful impact. You can also make a difference by representing on the platforms you built. If you know me, you're probably sick of me talking about Monk's Corner or South Carolina, but there's a reason I do that. I need to let the people back there know I haven't forgotten about them, that they do matter. That's why you probably already know that Jay is from Brooklyn, LeBron is from Akron, and Kendrick is from Compton. We all appreciate what our hometowns have done for us. We're all committed to inspiring future generations. Sometimes people ask me, being that you rep South Carolina so hard, does it bother you that your kids are going to grow up repping Jersey? I have thought about it, but at the end of the day, if having my kids rep the South was that important to me, then that's where they would live. Do they have a connection to South Carolina? Absolutely. Do they love going down there to visit family? Without a doubt. But it's still foreign territory to them at the end of the day. They're going to be East Coasters, and that's cool. Almost every city I go to, New York, L.A., Chicago, Philly, I'll meet someone who will tell me, oh, I got family down South. I used to go down there for summers when I was a kid. That's who my kids are going to be when they grow up. City kids who have a connection to the South. And that's fine. Still ain't forgave myself. Sometimes I feel uncomfortable even talking about survivor's guilt because it makes me wonder, have I really survived the hood? Yes, I'm physically not there any longer, but will my past still catch up with me? People who grew up in the streets don't tend to spend a lot of time thinking about the poor decisions we made. We're quick to chalk it up to the game. As my man Prodigy said, there's a war going on outside no man is safe from. When you're in combat, you don't get caught up worrying about collateral damage. My crew and I fancied ourselves soldiers. We were fighting in a war and weren't required to pray for repentance and forgiveness from a higher power for what we did. I now understand that was a mistake. Needing to ask for forgiveness is one of the biggest issues I've confronted through therapy. Like most hood dudes, I spent a lot of time talking about how the streets affected me. What I haven't given nearly enough thought to is the effect I had on other people. That's something I haven't wanted to confront. I haven't wanted to consider the people who were shot at because of my crew. The people we jumped, we robbed. The families whose lives were impacted by the drugs they got from us. I haven't wanted to try to come to terms with that. While I was writing this book, a young lady did an interview and claimed I had sexually assaulted her at a party in 2001. I didn't do it. Some people said she was resurfacing because I was a celebrity. At the end of the day, the why doesn't matter. She was impacted by what happened at the party. That's the bottom line. And I hadn't spent much time thinking about her pain. When I told the story of the party and black privilege, it had been from my perspective. I had wanted to illustrate how scared I had been by the allegations and how I didn't want to find myself in that situation again. I wanted to highlight the moment when I realized it was finally time to leave my street friends behind once and for all. In retrospect, I had been thinking too much about how that night affected my life. I hadn't given much thought at all to how it had hurt her. Obviously, her reappearance in my life made me look at the situation in a whole new light. What I saw wasn't pretty. I'd been extremely selfish in how I told that story. My only concern was how it had impacted me, not how it had impacted a teenage girl. When I realized how selfish I'd been, I started reexamining many more situations from that period of my life. I was abusive to my teachers. I disrespected elders in my community. To say nothing of the fact I used to sell crack. I impacted a lot of people's lives negatively just because I wanted more money in my pocket and thugs to respect me. To make matters worse, I'd gotten in the habit of patting myself on the back because I made it out of the streets. Yes, I made it, but at what cost? I've evolved from that selfish, destructive young man, but does that absolve me of the damage I've done? That's a question I've been grappling with a lot in therapy through those conversations. I find myself not only asking for the forgiveness of others, but also for the ability to forgive myself. T.I., one of my 7 favorite rappers of all time, has a song called Still Ain't Forgave Myself, which features the hook. All the mistakes made on this road to wealth. Hey, what I am today, I made myself, but I still ain't forgave myself. I feel the exact same way T.I. does. I know if I don't seek true forgiveness for my past transgressions, my anxiety will always play tricks on me. Indiscretutionalized. When it comes to reconciling where I've been and where I'm at now, another one of the anxieties I've learned to let go of is my fear of being of the industry. For those who didn't read Black Privilege, I'm referring to the advice Wendy Williams once gave me. You're either of the people or of the industry. By that, Wendy meant as you begin to gain popularity and access, you're going to have to make a fundamental choice. You're either going to prioritize your relationship with your audience, aka the people, which means asking artists hard questions during interviews and refusing to play music business politics, or you're going to be of the industry, which means you're going to prioritize your relationships with the artists, managers, publicists, A&Rs, and advertisers. You'll play things safe and be willing to ask softball questions during interviews in order to keep the industry happy. Wendy's philosophy was that once you're of the industry, you lose your edge and your connection to your audience. That made a lot of sense to me. So for many years, being of the people was a top priority. I declined invitations to parties and trips because they felt too industry. If a rapper wanted to get dinner, I'd say no. If a producer wanted my opinion on a track, depending on who it was, I had no problem pulling up and giving it to them. But that's where it stopped. I sent a clear signal to not try to offer me anything out of the goodness of your heart because my opinion could not be bought. Industry people want you to accept a favor from them as they believe that once you have, you will abide by the code to never say a negative word about them, which is complete bullshit. Don't get mad when I tell you your shit was whack or tell the world via radio your shit was whack. I wouldn't lie to my real friends, so why would I lie to you? That's what the old industry does. Circle jerk each other and lie to one another. What I've learned over the last few years, however, is the old industry is dying fast. I am of the new industry. And it's okay. I've been part of the radio TV industry for 20 years now. It's only natural that I'm going to gravitate toward and build relationships with people who do the same kind of work and share the same passions that I do. If anything, it would be unhealthy if I wasn't building those sort of relationships. I started in radio, but since then I've evolved. I've branched off into other industries like books, TV, film, and podcasts. As I've grown, I've watched other people who also started at the bottom. You can't get more bottom than getting fired from a radio station in Columbia, South Carolina. Make similar strides in their own careers. People who started as interns, board ops, overnight hosts, and struggling rappers, but who now are calling their own shots. People who I dreamed with, plotted with, broke bread with, who shared my dreams and are now in positions of power through media and other forms of entertainment. The other day I woke up and glanced at my call log from the day before. The names I saw shocked me. Lil Duval, Killer Mike, Kanye, Pete Davidson, Tip, Angela Rye, Tiffany Haddish, and Amanda Seals. Then I saw a group chat with Hovain, manager of the Locks and Wale, Rob Markman from Genius, Nessa Diab, and T.T. Torres of Hot 97. I went to high school with T.T. B-Dot from Rap Radar and Cavs from the Flagrant 2 podcast and Uninterrupted is the Score. I looked back at my phone and said, what have I become? I'm doing exactly what Wendy warned me about. I'm selling out the people for the industry. I started to panic. Not heeding your former mentor's advice is a great way to ruin your career. Was that what I was doing? Then I caught myself and said, there's nothing to be ashamed of here. There's nothing to panic over. Instead, thank God you have those relationships with such talented and interesting people because we are the industry now. The reason I was able to catch myself and calm down was because I knew all those relationships were genuine. They weren't people I met over a line of coke at a penthouse party or on a yacht in St. Barts. I'd met many of these people over a decade ago, long before they had achieved the level of fame they have today. For instance, I met Killer Mike in Columbia, South Carolina in 2003, when he was signed to Big Boy from Outkast's Purple Ribbon All-Stars label. We remained tight. I met Lil Duval in 2006 on MySpace and immediately started working on the Hood State of the Union videos and have been friends ever since. I met Tip in 2002 when he was in between his record deal with LaFace and Atlantic. And Amanda Seales and I used to do a TV show together on MTV called Hip Hop POV in 2012. After tapings, I would drop her off to her crib in Harlem in my 2003 Escalade with more than 200,000 miles on it. I met Tiffany Haddish more than 12 years ago, but we didn't really start communicating and bonding until late 2016. Now that's my homie. I love her. She'll come to the house for dinner, and I can count on two hands how many people have been to my crib and met my kids. I met Pete Davidson when he was 17 years old after a taping of MTV's Guy Code, and he tagged along to a dinner with Duval and me. Since then, Pete and I talk all the time. Our relationship is very deep. I've literally talked him off the ledge several times. I'm friends with his mother and his sister. I don't care if he's on Saturday Night Live. Pete's my guy. My industry relationships are genuine, and the connections are real. It's a new industry that we rise in together. I've also been fortunate to build relationships with some really talented people who likewise came from South Carolina. Bakari Sellers, a former state representative and a CNN commentator, has been a friend for years. We connected because of our common South Carolina roots. It's the same with Chadwick Boseman. We linked up 3 or 4 years ago when we realized we were both from South Carolina. Today he's the Black Panther and one of the biggest movie stars in the world. I could have never predicted that. He's someone I call homie because he's from South Carolina like me. I've got a similar relationship with Stephen Colbert. He's also from South Carolina. And his brother was even my English teacher back in high school. You don't think we have some common ground? Of course we do. So why wouldn't we be friends? From now on, I'm being friends with the people I feel a connection with and supporting the artists I feel deserve my support. Take my relationship with Cardi B. I've been supporting her since I first saw her on Instagram and thought she was funny with a unique POV. Nobody was pushing her or offering me anything to co-sign her. I just liked her. In fact, Cardi has said plenty of times herself, Charlamagne believed in me when none of these other motherfuckers did. Still, to hear social media tell it, I've been trying to cash in on her fame. I saw one guy post a picture of me with a platinum plaque Cardi's label Atlantic Records had sent me. Mind you, almost everyone in the music industry, especially radio, gets plaques from labels. See? Look at Charlamagne posing with that platinum record for Bodak Yellow, he wrote. You know he's definitely getting a check from her. In the past, I would have let a comment like that, no matter how ridiculous, get under my skin. I would have thought I wasn't getting paid, but maybe it looks like I am getting too close to the artist. I need to back up. I'm not worried about that nonsense anymore. I support Cardi because she's a talented artist who has remained 100% authentic through all the ups and downs. I think that's an important example for other girls coming up from the hood. I think examples like Cardi's have made it easier to accept being of the industry. That's because industry isn't the same as it once was. The world Wendy was describing is fading away. Someone like Cardi didn't follow a traditional path to become the hottest female rapper in the game. She didn't have to spend years pitching her demo to a major label, and then the label made her famous through its marketing campaigns. Instead, she created her own buzz through social media, TV, and mixtapes. Then when she had all the leverage, she signed a deal. That's the difference between now and where things were 10 or 15 years ago. People like Cardi are taking their destinies in their own hands, creating their own lanes, and building their own fan bases. That means the people and not the industry are deciding who and what they fuck with. The industry can't rely on the same cookie-cutter formulas they used in the past. The labels, networks, and stations are being forced to accept and tolerate non-traditional energy and approaches. The result is that real, authentic people are getting opportunities they never received before. And when they do succeed, they're becoming the new industry. That's why I can't feel bad about being of the industry anymore. Nope. No need to have anxiety over selling out because I'm not selling out. It's just now the industry is buying in to real. I'm part of a new movement. A new industry where nobody is a gatekeeper because there are no gates. We control the cool. And I represent a generation of hustlers who truly do it for the culture and not the industry. Dropping my demons. While I always cherish my overall experiences in Mount's Corner, I did do plenty of things there that I'm not proud of today. I've sold drugs to my community. I've cheated on the woman I love. I was involved in a shooting that could have left someone dead. One of the best things about therapy is that it gives you space to confront your demons, to take the shit you've been trying to hide in the back of your mind and finally hold it up to the light. Therapy allows you to take a clear look and examine it for what it is. This is necessary because you're never going to make progress if you don't confront the things in your past that are still weighing you down emotionally. In high school, I had a situation with a beautiful young lady who we can call Tiki. She had been on and off with my cousin Evan throughout most of middle and high school. Then one summer, she and Evan started going through it, and Tiki began calling me for guidance. Like I told you earlier, people coming to me for guidance has been a reoccurring theme in my life. Like I also said earlier, relationships between men and women that are built on advice often become physical. That was the case with us. I started off giving her advice, and soon I found myself giving her something else entirely. And she opened my eyes to how good sex could be. If she'd call and tell me to come over, I'd sneak out my window, jump on my dirt bike, and pedal the 5 miles to her house without even thinking twice about it. I just couldn't get enough of her. People who knew us, however, didn't approve of our relationship. People were saying, how did y'all end up together? Lenard and Evan are really good friends, plus they're related. It seemed foul to a lot of folks in town, almost like incest. It was foul, but this girl had me so open, I couldn't care less about what people were saying. Tiki absolutely blew away anyone I had ever been with before. We'd be playing Jodeci, H-Town, Silk, all that fly shit that was popping in the mid-90s during our lovemaking sessions, and she would just wear me out. I was wrapped around her finger, and she knew it. I even went to the mall and bought her a heart-shaped gold ring. I could barely afford it, but I wanted her to know how much I loved her. Do you know this young lady had the audacity to get the ring appraised? Who the hell gets the ring appraised as a teenager? Tiki, that's who. It must not have been appraised for much because Tiki started clowning me about how cheap that ring was. The problem was, Tiki had an older half-sister, let's call her Lisa, who was into dating guys with money, including a few drug dealers. These guys were buying her real gold, nice clothes, and even cars. Everything I did was being compared to them, and there was no way I could measure up. I became wildly insecure about pleasing Tiki, which just made my efforts fall even shorter each time. The harder I tried to impress her, the less interest Tiki seemed to have in me. It got to the point where I was having panic attacks because she wouldn't take my phone calls anymore or answer the door when I rang. One of my attacks was so bad that my mother called my father and had him come talk to me. When he found me, I was babbling about how I loved Tiki and didn't understand why she didn't want to be with me. As was his custom, my father didn't pull any punches and got to the unromantic heart of the matter. You got your nose open over this girl and she out here fucking you and probably everybody else in a 30-mile radius? He scolded me. I realize now that he would probably have said that about any girl making me crazy, but hearing it then instantly calmed me down. My cousins had been telling me she was no good for me since Tiki and I first got together, but I chalked it up to them being haters. They were just jealous because I had Tiki and they didn't. I had to accept what my father was telling me was the truth. Once I regained my sense, I stopped sweating her, stopped being so clingy. I fell completely back and didn't call her or try to see her. Within 48 hours, she called me up and wanted to know where I'd been. I managed to play it cool for a few days and act like I wasn't interested anymore, but eventually we had sex again, and I immediately went right back to being completely sprung. One night, Tiki and I were hanging out in my mom's house. My mom had a policy where I had to keep my door open, so Tiki and I devised a little routine by which we would slyly have sex. I'd stand up against the wall next to the open door and pull out my little meat. Tiki would stand in front of me, pull her shorts to the side, and I'd get a couple pumps in with my mother none the wiser. I guess Tiki got bored with our little game because after a while she announced she was going to hang out with Lisa. I didn't want her to go, even begged for her to stay, but Tiki wasn't trying to hear it and took off to go see Lisa. All I could do the rest of the night was lie in bed and obsess over the idea that Tiki was out there running around with all the older drug dealers Lisa was down with. Guys who had their own apartments and could afford hotel rooms. It was driving me insane. Finally, I did what all people who suffer from anxiety do at 1 a.m. when they can't sleep. I went out for a walk. It just so happened that Lisa only lived a short ways down my dirt road, so I headed over there to see what I might find. It wasn't a long walk, but it added to my anxiety because when you're out in the country at that time of night, all you can hear is the loud drone of insects and unidentified animals howling in the woods. I got to Lisa's right at the same time her car pulled up to their driveway. They must have seen me lurking in the shadows because Tiki hopped out and said, "What the hell are you doing out here?" "Slanging," I stupidly replied. It was stupid because I wasn't doing that yet. Tiki let out a huff at my foolishness and went back to the car, at which point I noticed an older dude, probably around 25, sitting in the back seat. "Who's that?" I demanded. "Oh, that's just our cousin," Tiki replied. Right about then, I noticed that Tiki smelled like sex. "What does sex smell like?" you ask. "The perfect mixture of a Soul Cycle class and a cake store." "You smell like you were fucking," I told her. "Yeah, because you and me had sex tonight," she replied, and then went into the house with her sister and her sister's cousin. There was nothing to do but go home, but in my mind, something wasn't right. There was no way our little stand-up sex had left her smelling like that. I became convinced that Tiki was sleeping with Lisa's cousin. Because I had no confidence in myself, I couldn't let it go. Over the next couple of days, I kept brooding over what Tiki must be up to. Finally, I couldn't take it anymore and decided to take a walk over to the cousin's house, which also wasn't too far from my mom's house. When I got to his yard, it sounded like someone was blasting a porno over club speakers. There was no denying it. I could clearly hear Tiki's voice screaming a name in ecstasy from inside the house. A name that very clearly wasn't mine. Standing outside this older guy's house and listening to him Wu-Tang torture my girl's womb, suddenly all my fears, all my insecurities, and all my paranoia hit me at once. For a brief moment, I thought about killing myself. If I'd had a gun on me, I probably would have. Thankfully, I didn't. I also didn't have any weed or liquor to help numb the pain. So I just stumbled out of his yard and sat down on the side of the dirt road where I proceeded to cry my eyes out. At that point, one of my homeboys, let's call him Buns, happened to come down the street and saw me sitting there in tears. He just shook his head and said, "It's Tiki, ain't it?" I said, "Yes," and then explained what I just had heard. "She's getting fucked right now," he asked. "Man, let's go listen." For some reason, I agreed to return to the scene of the crime. But we had barely approached his house before we heard Tiki screaming. "Whoa, he fucking the shit out of her," exclaimed Buns. That pretty much put my insecurity through the roof. To his credit, Buns stayed with me and tried to help me see the big picture. Women are like buses. If you miss one, in the next 10 minutes, another one coming. That helped me calm down a bit, and I agreed it was time to let Tiki go once and for all. My plan worked for 3 days. Until Tiki called and invited herself over to my mom's home. All my resolution to leave Tiki alone melted in a matter of seconds. While I waited for her to show up, my mind began racing over why she was actually coming to see me. Does this mean she does love me? I asked myself. Then I started thinking that maybe it meant that the older dude wasn't properly dicking her down, as if my ears had been deceiving me. Man, if I can blow her back out today, she'll probably stick with me for good, I told myself. This is my chance. I gotta really put it down. By the time Tiki showed up, I was a nervous wreck. I wasn't sure what was gonna happen, but we immediately got down to the business of having sex. Sadly, instead of blowing out her back, I let the pressure get to me. I performed more like the guys Missy Elliott was talking about in One Minute Man. Hell, I probably didn't even last that long. I'm talking I got maybe 5 or 6 pumps and it was over. When Tiki realized what had happened, she was downright disgusted. She pushed me off her and started yelling, "See, that's why I'm fucking," insert older dude's name here, "now." When Tiki said that, I'd never felt so sorry in my life. All I could see was white light. My heart started beating so hard in my chest that I could hear it. I felt a knot grow in my throat, and I became extremely angry. Now, I don't condone ever getting physical with a woman. But when she kicked my already severely bruised ego by making fun of my premature ejaculation, the truth is, I snapped. I could barely see straight and mushed her with my elbows. I was in a rage for about 10 seconds before I snapped out of it and realized I fucked up badly. I hadn't used my hands, but it didn't matter. I'd gone out like a sucker. I immediately tried apologizing to Tiki, but she wasn't trying to hear it. Instead, she started tearing down pictures I had of her up on my wall and ripping them to shreds. Every time I got near her to try to get her to stop, she'd start swinging at me. Eventually, a friend of ours came and picked her up to take her home. Tiki told her mother, the OG Gretchen, what I did. Gretchen rightfully was upset and called me on the phone. "I'm so disappointed in you," she told me. "I would never think you would do something like this." I didn't have a good answer for her. Remember when I said there was a period when I kept getting in fights and couldn't defend myself? Those incidents all took place right after my phone call with Gretchen. At the time, I attributed them to not being able to defend myself to the roots Gretchen must have put on me for what I did to her daughter. In fact, up until very recently, I believed that all those beatings I took were because Gretchen had essentially cast a spell over me. It wasn't until I started going to therapy that I was able to grapple with this incident and start to understand that my actions or lack thereof during that period had nothing to do with Gretchen and everything to do with my inability to come to terms with what had happened with Tiki. Tiki and I still kicked it for a while after that, but for decades I had been carrying around this delusion that somehow she had wronged me by cheating on me with an older dude, that she had been responsible for my anxiety attacks while we were together and indirectly responsible for what happened afterward. Another thing I got wrong was partly blaming her for selling drugs. It was after my relationship with Tiki imploded that I started my relationship with the streets. In my mind, if I just had the trappings of a drug dealer, the nice cars, the real gold, my own apartment, then maybe Tiki would have been more into me. I can't say that I started dealing drugs because of her, but I did feel a need to prove myself after losing her to that older dude. I can now see, however, that all I had really done is trade one bad relationship for another. In the end, dealing drugs didn't leave me any more fulfilled, and it would prove just as damaging. What my therapist has helped me see is that while I can't go back and undo what happened with Tiki, I can learn from it. What I can learn from it is, I have to have the strength to detach from toxic relationships once I realize I'm not happy with where things are going. Obviously, I'm not dating anymore, but there are other relationships, both professional and personal, that still feel harmful to me. I have to let go of those. The first step in doing that is put the responsibility on myself. For years and years, I had blamed Tiki for what happened. She manipulated me. She forced me to lose my mind. I can now see that's just weakness on my part. Tiki was just a kid who herself was getting manipulated by that older guy. The truth is, I had an extremely fragile ego. I talked tough, but my confidence was brittle. I was very insecure and couldn't handle being with someone who seemed so much more mature than me. My therapist has also led me to understand that in order to fully move on from a toxic relationship, I need to have closure. You can't just drift away from it. There has to be a moment where you and the other person know it's over. In this case, I had always felt I'd achieved that, though I hadn't known what to call it at the time. While I eventually lost touch with Tiki, I did stay close to her mother, Gretchen. I made sure to visit and call Gretchen as much as I could because I really respected her. During one of our last conversations before she passed from a long illness, she told me, "You know, Leonard, you're a good person. You just have to learn some lessons." When she said that, it felt like a weight had been lifted off my shoulders. It didn't absolve me from what I'd done, but I felt better knowing I had Gretchen's forgiveness. I vowed to never make the same mistake again and have lived up to it.
Fear of losing my roots and dropping my demons. Clinical correlation. One of the things we teach in therapy is the difference between your public self and your private self. That is, the difference between the way you see yourself and the way you think other people see you. Oftentimes, there's a huge gap between the two. Trying to reconcile the difference between the two sides of this coin can feel like an uphill battle that you're always losing. And you will lose this battle every single time until you finally realize it's not a battle you actually have to fight. Because the truth is, you will never be able to control what someone else thinks of you. It's hard enough to control our own minds, much less everyone else's. The key is to control what you can, and that's only yourself. Specifically, how you feel about yourself, how you see yourself, how close you feel you are to living your most authentic life on a moment-to-moment basis. Once you satisfy the balance of that equation, you'll never have to worry about satisfying what everyone else thinks of you because you will have wrapped yourself firmly in the knowledge of self that keeps you focused on your purpose as you move through the world. When you know who you are, you never have to worry about how to act or what to do in any situation. You can just relax and be you. A huge take-home lesson from this chapter is the idea of survivor's guilt, which is a very common theme in the Black community that has to do with the concept of coming from humble beginnings and going on to becoming successful, and specifically concerning the feelings you have about those family members and friends you knew who didn't. There's guilt about surviving, guilt about what you should have done, and guilt about what you had to do to get out, particularly whom you had to leave behind. There's an old saying we hold near and dear to our hearts in the African-American community, and that's, if you forget where you're from, you're never going to make it where you're going. It's empowering and limiting all at the same time. Remember, two things can be true. The truth is that you should never be ashamed of where you're from or who you're from. The trick is to stop telling that story from a victim's perspective and tell that story from a place of power, in which you can show all the obstacles you had to overcome to make it, and let everyone know that if not for the love and tough lessons you learned back then, you wouldn't be the person you are today. Learn to retell that story triumphantly. The other truth to this statement that holds people back is that they make a false assumption in thinking this means you can never turn the page on the person you used to be without turning away from the people too. That's simply not true. Oscar Wilde wrote, "The aim of life is self-development. To realize one's nature perfectly, that is what each of us is here for." You absolve yourself of the survivor's remorse by reminding yourself of this idea and using that to refocus you on your purpose every day. You absolve yourself of the guilt by remembering the people who struggled and sacrificed for you to have a chance to make it, and honor them by living your best life. You absolve yourself of the guilt by realizing that the best way to save people is not by rubbing salve on their ego wounds by rejoining the fold. It's by blazing the trail and being the living example of how they can follow the steps you took to get similar results on their path. Your job is to lead first, then give back. The Sankofa bird is a mythical bird of West African, specifically Ghana, origin. The word translates to, "Go back and get it." It's represented as a bird that flies forward while looking backward with an egg, which symbolizes the future, in its mouth. Understanding your past informs your present and ensures your future. Your job is to be that bird. From working with people from all walks of life, I've learned that the secret to happiness and sustained success isn't the achievement of a specific goal. Happiness isn't a result, it's a choice. Happiness is being able to enjoy the person you're becoming all along the way. Life is about growth. Life is about learning. Life is about evolving into the person you were put here to become. It's impossible to do that while trying to stay the same. You're not here to be stagnant water. You're here to flow in whatever direction the current of your purpose pulls you. The critical moment in any doctor-client therapeutic relationship comes when we look to see if you'll be able to do what we refer to as heeding the call to normalcy. Sadly, everybody isn't able. But for those who can, you'll find that the biggest hurdle to doing so isn't making up for what you don't have or overcoming what you've been through or gathering the tools you need to take the next step forward. The biggest hurdle to living the life that was truly meant for you is simply giving yourself permission to do so. It's okay. You're worth it. Being in love with another person is hard. Learning how to be in love with ourselves is even harder. And nothing cuts quite so deep as the rejection associated with the first love. That's the worst. Charlemagne asked the one question that everyone who's ever had a heartbreak asks.
Why?
Ask a terrible question, your brain has no choice but to give you a terrible answer, which in this case was, because who you are isn't enough for her. And from there, things go completely off the rails. Rejection triggers uncertainty and insecurity inside us. Rejection helps us to believe that the worst we think about ourselves may actually be true. Once that message lands and your deepest, darkest thoughts are confirmed, it makes you feel a certain type of way. Anxious, embarrassed, ashamed, defeated, guilty, frustrated, angry, and ultimately enraged. Think, feel, do. We think a thought, we feel a corresponding emotion. We take a consequent action. There's no rage more dangerous than that of a teenager who hasn't yet learned the critical life skill of impulse control and feels justified in taking action, however poorly thought out and violent it may be. Bad things happen. Things that, at their most unfortunate, can change the course of a young life forever. As a man with 5 sisters and 8 aunts whom I love dearly, let me be absolutely crystal clear. Hitting a woman is wrong. Putting your hands on a woman in frustration or anger is wrong. Physically intimidating a woman for any reason is wrong. Doing anything to make someone feel less than is just wrong. I don't care what she said, what she did, or what she promised to do. Hitting a woman is never an option. Charlemagne knew he had done wrong the second after it happened, but when you're hurt and angry, the only thing you want to do is protect yourself and hurt back. People who are hurt, hurt other people. It's up to you to recognize that about yourself. Take responsibility for your part in it, hold yourself accountable, and stop the cycle. Which is what he ultimately did. There are 3 things you need to get over any big hurt. Understanding, forgiveness, and closure. Super simple concepts to grasp, but exceedingly difficult things to obtain. Charlemagne understood it was the realization of his own insecurity that fueled his rage and poured more gasoline on his anxiety bonfire. Anxiety is at its height when the things you think about yourself and feel about yourself and do with yourself don't match. In this situation, his actions didn't match what he knew about himself deep down, and it caused an explosion of emotion. All has to be in order for your life to feel in order. In his attempt to put those things back in line, he sought forgiveness from the young woman's mother and was grateful to receive it. Ultimately, once you're able to forgive yourself and make the corresponding changes to make sure that never happens again in your life or the lives of those people you're lucky enough to affect, that leads to closure. This is how you heal. We all make mistakes. We've all hurt someone either intentionally or unintentionally in the past. Understand it. Seek forgiveness. And if it's not available from them, give it to yourself. Close the loop. Move on with your life and do everything you can to make sure it doesn't happen in the lives of anyone close to you. We repeat what we can't repair. The cycle of anxiety, anger, and explosions is all too familiar in our community for a myriad of reasons. And trust me, it's not a cycle that will serve you or anyone in your family well. Charlemagne was able to break his cycle. It's up to all of us to follow his lead and press pause on our own pathological patterns long enough to make a change.
Chapter 6. Parental Paranoia. My daughter Zara has asthma and spent the night in the hospital. I had no idea I could be scared like that. I was always one to just go, "Ah, I'm not dying or anything." Until you have a kid that you would give your life for, you have no idea that all of this is in you. A quote from the god Chris Rock. Every parent worries about their kids. It comes with the territory of being a parent. From stressing about the possibility of their toddler bumping their head on a playground set, to freaking out when they go off to college. Parents spend an incredible amount of time worrying about the possible dangers that may be lurking just around the corner. Out of all the anxieties we can suffer from, parental paranoia is the one that probably makes the most sense. Our fundamental job as a parent is to keep our kids safe. As I've said, my parental business card might as well read, protect, and provide. When we fear for our kids or try to steer them away from potential threats, we're just being good protectors. It's in our DNA. If we're judging by that standard, I'm a great parent, and I mean world class.